Jay, thank you. You know, I've known you more than 10 years, and you are a longstanding member of my in-person book club. And you're the first book club member who has retired to write a novel. So what happens next? How did you get this published? How were you successful in persuading influence makers to try to make this a blockbuster?
Huge amount of luck. I had some early readers, mostly friends and family. I had to first see if I could write something that people thought was compelling, interesting, well written. So I just kept writing one foot in front of another. And then through introductions, one friend to another, I met Sloan Harris, who is the head of literary at ICM. I sent Sloan a first draft, a very rough draft. I've since rewritten the book four times. But Sloan saw something in it because he took me on as a client, nursed me through the first two revisions, and then encouraged me, introduced me to the editor-in-chief of Scribner's, Colin Harrison. Really, through a lot of luck, I got a dream team, one of the top agents in the business, and an absolutely brilliant editor to support me.
Your novel reminded me of the works of Tom Wolfe and Tom Clancy, and you use incredibly detailed descriptions like Tom Wolfe used in Bonfire of the Vanities. Your book also had a military aspect that reminded me of Tom Clancy's classics. Now, I'm a hedge fund guy. I'm interested in politics. I've met politicians and all the key decision makers. And I'm aware of how these people dress, how they think, how they behave. And you really deep dive into the minutia. I didn't even know you were that observant, to be honest with you. It's fantastic.
Look, one of the great things about being in the hedge fund business is that you get to meet a lot of people. You're paid to meet people. You're paid to go and see people all over the world. And if you're paying a little bit of attention, you get a picture very quickly of who they are and how they operate, what makes them tick. Tom Wolfe was a huge influence on me. He's a stunning writer. He was a genius at social commentary. And I hope I've captured some of that. I wanted my characters to really be classically Wolfian. Clancy was also a huge influence. The military strategic elements were really important. But the other guy that I read a lot throughout the writing is Norman Mailer, both for style and this amazing book that he wrote, Harlot's Ghost, which is a story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, his version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I recommend it to anyone who's interested in geopolitics and policy.
Your book reminded me of Robert Penn Warren's novel, All the King's Men, because all the major characters have done something in the past that they were embarrassed about and are desperate to keep private. How does this concept of secrecy influence you?
Everybody has secrets, especially the characters in my book. They've all got foibles. You could say some are immoral. Maybe they're all immoral. But I think they're all heroic, each in his own way, even though they're dangerous, self-involved, and some would say more than a few are psychopaths. The point I'm trying to make, the red pill I'm hoping people will swallow when they read Under Money, is to think critically about everything they read in the press, about what's going on in the world, because people don't realize or think enough about the fact that money is beneath the surface of absolutely everything that happens. It doesn't matter if it's the public sector, the private sector, a charitable organization, an NGO, a company, it's always the money. Even when the purpose of an organization is high-minded and principled, it's still the money. And that's where the term undermoney comes in. When my son David was in Japan, he befriended a restaurateur, Sao Asano, who runs Robitaille in Roppongi. And when Asano visited New York, we took him out to a restaurant and I asked him, my translator, my son, said, is it any different opening a restaurant in New York versus a restaurant in Tokyo? And Asano said, it's the same, undermoney. And he rubbed his fingers together and he gestured under the table with his hand. That's where I first heard the term undermoney, which, by the way, Larry, I want to take credit for this. I think I will have introduced a new word, undermoney, into the English language, which refers to the rivers of money that influence and seeps through and controls everything, controlling events and people.
I think it's hilarious that you're introducing a new word to the English language, and on the very first page of your book, you open with a dictionary definition of undermoney. It's not even a word yet, but there's the definition you want for the next edition of Webster's.
For sure. How do I get that done?
I think it's probably a money problem.
You got to find out who to give the money to. I want to give Colin Harrison, my editor, credit for the idea of including an actual definition. He said, because it's a new word, you should really have a definition. So I'm just going to read it. It's not very long. Undermoney is money which is unknown publicly that controls individuals and events, The Currency of Corruption, Bribery. See also Blood Money. And that's the essence of what this novel is about.
Okay, let's talk about sex. We've never broached the topic of women, let alone sex, in our dozens of previous conversation. Yet your book has plenty of sex. How did that come to be? Was it the editor's idea? Who told you to put so much sex into this book?
Originally, it had no sex. It was totally cerebral. My characters were kind of cool and calculating, but not very sexy. And we could easily have discussed it all in one of our sexless lunch or dinner conversations. Even though maybe sex is like money, it's under the surface everywhere all the time. When I was working with my agent, with Sloan, he said, "These are powerful people. They're having sex. You've got to put sex in the book." So I put in some sex, and then the draft got to Colin Harrison, who's written half a dozen novels, and he told me to put in more sex. So I went home, I told my family, and one of my kids said, "No, no, Dad, I can't have you writing about sex. That's just crazy." And I said, it's what I've got to do. So I put in more sex. And then I got back to Colin's desk, and he said, "There's too much sex." And I said, "It's too late. It's already there."
That's fantastic. The hedge fund industry plays a central role in the book, and hedge funds enter the public zeitgeist through the television program Billions. And in that TV show, we saw the inner workings of a hedge fund and the interactions between the various players. But in your book, we only get to observe one man in action. Why did you choose to limit it to just the most senior hedge fund manager and not his entire team?
It was a matter of simplicity. It's, in my experience, most hedge funds are completely honest. They do things by the book. But what we've read about is the bad guys, the single actors, and even though they have teams, guys like Bernie Madoff and Alan Sanford. But what I wanted to explore was the what if, the possibility that if your only business was trading on inside information and your only business was having absolute certainty as to future events, what would that look like? How much money could you make? How would you do it? And I thought it was just more straightforward to have one really ruthless, crazy trader rather than to have a whole cast of hedge fund characters. So this is a man who doesn't trade anything unless he knows the outcome at the start. He's the ultimate inside trader.
Your concept of insider trading is different than mine. Instead of trading on non-public information, the character buys put options on a refining company, and then he has others blow up the plant. I'm not sure that's insider trading. I think it's just criminal actions. Why do you call it insider trading?
Larry, I think you're right. Maybe inside information is the wrong word, wrong term. In the book, I refer to something more broader. I call it making things happen. And maybe if someone took my character to court, they wouldn't be able to convict him. What I'm trying to explore is the toxic confluence of a Russian military contractor, military types, this corrupt hedge fund trader, and what happens when they come together, creating events, whether it's blowing up a factory, a ship, a bridge, or a country. They're always looking for an edge. They're always looking to create a situation and then trade on it. I think this happens in real life. For example, periodically when the Russians and the Saudis get together and they decide they're going to produce more oil or less oil, to my way of thinking, there's no way, I would say no way, that the Saudis and Russians aren't trading on the information. They're trading it up, down, sideways. That's what happens in undermoney. The characters are looking for events that will have a big financial impact. And of course, there's the final event, I'm not going to spoil it, where one that has an enormous financial impact around the world.
In the book, you reference the possibility of paying off the Mexican president to default on its government debt during a financial crisis. The trader could profit by shorting Mexican government bonds. I'm not sure that's a crime.
I agree. I think untoward things happen in third world countries in particular all the time. Things happen all the time because somebody's paid off. You can imagine a very simple example. Let's say a Mexican public official broods in a private meeting that they're going to have trouble making the next debt payment. Obviously, that would have a huge impact on the price of the debt and maybe on local equity markets as well. It does happen, I would say.
Actually, that seems like standard operating procedure in my emerging markets prop department. Let's talk about the military next. I never knew you were a lover of military action, weapons, and strategy. No, I always knew you were interested in foreign policy and the use of military force, but not the specific weapon. How did you happen to get interested in the detail of warfare?
My characters like blowing stuff up, so I had to figure out how they did it. And most of what I wrote about, I learned by doing the research. Frankly, using Google, Google is amazing. But there's a whole section in the book that deals with what's happening in Syria. And in researching it, I learned a lot about Russian, American, Syrian weapons, their military strategies. But I also had the benefit of two ex-military guys who read drafts of my novel and guided me. So they made sure that I got things right. And so far, no one's complained. I was particularly interested in researching what a female agent might carry as weapons. Greta Webb, who's the other protagonist, is never without a knife or a gun. And for her, the question was always, what would look good under my skirt?
An Armani skirt.
Always. She's an Armani girl.
Love that.
The military guys in this book are unhappy with how the military operates. They think NATO is bullshit. They think that most of the wars we fought since the Korean War have been pointless, ill-conceived, poorly managed, cost a lot of lives, cost a lot of money. And they're students of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex, and they're disgusted by it.
Samuel Huntington's book, The Soldier and the State, discusses the military deference to civilian control. And in your novel, there's a desire to follow the president and his cabinet in the decision-making process, as well as the role of Congress in overseeing it. Now, the good guys want to use their ill-gotten money to persuade the American people to elect a leader who shares their political philosophy. How do you think about the soldier and the state in the context of your novel?
I think that soldiers have captured the state. The relationship between members of our military and Congress is, in particular, is uncomfortably close. The military has done a great job over a very long period of time of buying off congressmen and senators by locating bases and weapons manufacturing in many congressional districts. Very clever strategy, but it becomes an incestuous relationship with the military always wanting more toys and the political class always wanting more money spent in their neighborhoods. It's classic undermoney. It's undermoney at work. And today I was reading about problems we have with $50 drones launched in swarms to bomb and destroy multimillion-dollar ships, planes, trains. That's part of the problem that characters in Undermoney want to solve. Money wasted on weapons and strategies that are outmoded but very expensive. I think if you were Russia today, you're in a better strategic position than the United States. They've got hackers. They can toy with our elections. They can toy with our companies. They can steal our data. And just take our Navy. If I were designing a Navy from scratch today, I wouldn't rely on aircraft carriers, because if there's a hot war with the Chinese or the Russians, aircraft carriers would be sitting ducks. They'd be sunk by hypersonic missiles in the first half hour.
Russia plays a very important role in the book. To what extent does your real-life experiences explain your portrayal of Russian oligarchs?
I've been to Russia maybe half a dozen times, and it's one of the scariest places I've ever traveled. Russia is controlled by crime families. The difference between Russia and, let's say, a smaller crime family like the Cosa Nostra, which controls Sicily. In Russia, they control a vast state with oil, gas, and a seat on the UN Security Council. Maybe the way to think about Russia is as a big hedge fund run by Vladimir Putin's lieutenants. Putin also controls the military. He's got private military companies that he can deploy to do his bidding in various theaters around the world. So whether it's the South China Sea, the Middle East, Latin America, Cuba, you've got a crime family with global reach. People talk about how much money Putin's made. He's rumored to be one of the richest men on the planet because he's tithing an entire nation. That's power.
You know, the novel also explores cultural literacy and appreciation for art and paintings. Why did you decide to include that dimension?
I love the contrast between brutality, cruelty, and ruthlessness on one hand, and culture and refinement on the other. It was really great fun to relate and conflate the two. In one scene, these Russian elite oligarchs are sitting on a yacht in the Mediterranean. They're eating caviar and blinis. They're talking about a rare painting that's just been given as a hostess gift. The wealthy Russians are just like wealthy people everywhere. They pride themselves in erudition, in music, art, literature, philosophy. The characters in Undermoney are very similar. They style themselves as contemporary moral and political philosophers, but at the same time, they'll stop at nothing. And that brutality and cruelty underlies everything they do, particularly because they're always making things happen, causing destruction of property, loss of life, all to make money.
In reading your novel, I was not familiar with the 19th century Russian painter Ilya Repin. How did you come to reference his art and make it core to your novel?
After retiring from the hedge fund business, I decided that I wanted to learn how to draw in a classical way. So I went to a school, Grand Central Atelier, which teaches classical art methods. And I took drawing classes. And I met a fabulous artist, Ted Minoff, who introduced me to Repin and his work. And in fact, Ted has named one of his kids Repin. And that's where I got the idea. Repin is one of the foremost painters in the Russian pantheon. The fact that his work is so highly prized made it the perfect foil for these characters.
I heard you signed up for a second book. How did you get a second book deal even before the release of your first one?
My first book is called Under Money. The second is going to be called Uncertainty. And just to be grandiose and ambitious, I hope there'll be a third book, and that's going to be called Unthinkable. Uncertainty, the second volume, will explore how people can manipulate the world, markets, and prices, just like in Under Money. But it'll also explore the question of what would happen if an American president had his own private army and had the ability to manipulate domestic politics very directly. And what would happen if that president was willing to take on the Chinese, really take on the Chinese?
I want to turn next to the interrelationship between the wealthy and the media, and how the wealthy can use the media to their ends. There's a character in Under Money who is paid off to spread misinformation. How do you think about the media's independence and its accuracy, and why did that become a focus in your book?
I don't think the media is independent by any stretch. Journalists want to sell books. They want to catch eyeballs. It's all about money, like every other business. Jeff Bezos, owning the Washington Post, of course people say it's hands off. Is that really possible? The New York Times is controlled by the Sulzberger family, but their biggest shareholder is Carlos Slim, a Mexican billionaire. The media interacts on a daily basis with politicians. You've got this combination of wanting to earn money and influence people, have access, and all those goals are inextricably linked by money.
You have a libertarian political philosophy. Why did you decide to embed your political beliefs in the character Ben Korn, who's running for political office?
Larry, you've let the cat out of the bag. I think Ben Korn is the candidate we've all been waiting for. Somebody who tells it as he sees it, says that both the left and the right are irresponsible. He's the guy that in another time Donald Trump might have been. Somebody who was willing to use a bully pulpit with frank talk to get people to come together in the middle.
Judge Richard Posner spoke to my book club years back about his book entitled Law and Literature. And in it, he said that literature allows us to create situations to evaluate legal principles that normal circumstances do not. And in your book, you gave a chance to think about Ben Korn, a rising politician who doesn't do the right things.
This is probably why there should have been more sex in the book from the very beginning. I probably missed something in these characters. I hope it's there now. Ben Korn, he's shtupping a journalist. And she's not just gorgeous. She's powerful in her own right. That's part of the attraction. He just can't help himself. And I think we're living in a world where people are driven by their sexual predilections and orientations. And those also drive everyday events. We can't ignore that. Why would someone who doesn't need to risk his political future by engaging that way with a journalist? Ego.
Trump is a politician who doesn't seem to care much about his airing his dirty underwear. Why does he seem uniquely able to say, fine, it's true, let's move on, where others have not? I mean, Bill Clinton denies Monica Lewinsky, I think, to this very day.
I wish I understood that better. Trump just didn't care. Maybe he didn't care enough. I think if Trump had cared a little bit more, he might be president today.
Jay, I end each episode on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic that if people understand the role that money plays in absolutely everything that goes on the planet, they might become more critical thinkers and make better decisions when they're casting their votes for elected officials. I think that's a cause for optimism.
Jay, thank you very much.
Larry, thank you.
Thanks to Jay and Ari for joining us today. That ends today's session. If you're interested in listening to a replay of today's What Happens Next program or any of our previous episodes, or you wish to read a transcript, you can find them on our website, whathappensnextin6minutes.com. Replays are also available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify.